I'm Kate Remington with Conrad Tau. He's going to be the piano soloist with the Ridgefield Symphony Orchestra on February 22nd in Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. And it's great to have a chance to talk with you again.
Thanks, Kate.
You know, it's so surprising that there was a time when Rhapsody in Blue was seen as experimental. And it was described as an experiment in music, and no one had really heard anything like that fusion. And I know that, you know, you do experimentation. You've written a work for piano and iPad, and you've really stretched the boundaries of music. So does that help you, the experimental pieces that you've written, does that help you kind of get inside of the context of Rhapsody in Blue a little bit?
Yeah, well, when Rhapsody in Blue was first premiered, I don't think the notion of classical crossover existed at all, right? That genre category only emerges, like, much later with the sort of market demand of, like, record stores or what have you. So I think the concept of taking like popular idioms and their musical vocabularies and making like concert music out of them was really new and surprising at the time. It resonates with what I'm doing just in the sense that like I have grown up absorbing all kinds of idioms of music. It's just literally just in the atmosphere of my life. And so, you know, I'm interested in working with as many tools as I can musically to do my stuff. I think I'm just greedy. I don't think of what I do as inherently experimental. I think I seek out experimental music a lot in my listening. I think it's such an incredible thing to try to look at someone working with this medium of sound for this strange thing that we call music and trying really hard to find their own language or vocabulary. So experimental musicians, the best experimental musicians really seem like they're speaking their own language. And yet somehow, and this for me is crucial, somehow there is still a feeling of some kind of recognition in the music. I think just in art in general, that's what I am chasing after. Like what I'm most attracted to in other people's work is like the feeling of like human recognition without being able to identify why. To me, that is the most exciting feeling. You know, when you're like, why is it that when I listen to these sounds, they might, on the surface, be completely unrecognizable and impossible for me to make any sense of rationally, but why do I feel some kind of resonance? To me, that's the most exciting thing. And so that's what I'm more motivated by than anything else. In my own work, I don't know. I mean, I'm not, you know, I think I'm just trying to communicate with the vocabulary that I have. And if I can somehow articulate my way of seeing how all of these different vocabularies are connected, that might be one of the threads. But really, I'm just trying to, you know, express myself in a way that feels really personal and honest. And so I think it just ends up being experimental in some ways just because of that. But it's not, you know, experimental is not necessarily the starting point.
Yeah, well, this is such an interesting time for music because it almost seems like there really aren't silos anymore. And sounds from other genres drift in and out. And in a way, because of the energy and all the different kinds of music that you can listen to now, it kind of seems like what was happening in the 1920s when jazz was starting to become a real mainstream and there were all these other genres. And so in a way, there are, I think, some parallels between Gershwin's time in the early 20s and when Rhapsody in Blue was new and our own time, which is really cool.
Well, I have a conflicted relationship with genre in general. I think that there's something incredibly beautiful in genre in the way that it is like evidence of shared vocabulary. It is evidence of this desire between groups, within groups of people, groups of creative people. And this, you know, often boils down in some ways to like locale and culture. So I think that genres are really beautiful evidence of like humans wanting to connect and share ideas and like be inspired by one another. I think though that the moment that genre gets calcified into something that exists in order to make the music easier to describe in like usually in a selling context, that's where I get uneasy, because then it starts to become like some sort of market imperative where it's like you have to adhere to genre conventions because otherwise it's not going to be recognizable as XYZ thing. And then I feel as though when we're talking about genre, or if the only context that we have to understand music is through genre or style, then I feel like we're always inevitably talking about the sort of cloud of associations around a thing instead of really interrogating what a thing is itself, listening to what the music is beyond simply what the music represents, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I feel like that's something. But then, I mean, the conflict for me, too, is that I also love genres. And I love things that are like sterling examples of genre craft. I think that, you know, like when really classic, great R&B is done well, because I love R&B, like, you know, there is such a unique satisfaction in like something that is just beautifully done. So, and also, you know, there's no escaping style either. There's no escaping genre, because genre is outside of any one person's intentions, I think, right? Genre is dependent on cultural context, and you know, it's also a product of the fact that there is a culture industry and a culture marketplace and stuff. So I feel like I don't want to deny that reality. And I also think that that cloud of associations is interesting, too. So I guess I'm always trying to balance these two things. So with Rhapsody in Blue, for example, like, I am trying to not deny the piece's referentiality to, like, Tin Pan Alley song form, and I'm trying to embrace all of the associations I might have with, like, a style of music that's being used in this piece. But also, for me, it's important to remember, like, I think if I had to prioritize one over the other, my priority is, what is this piece trying to achieve in its structure, in its form, what have you? Like, you know, it's an interesting, complex, it's a constellation. It's really quite cool to engage with.
Yeah, it is. And I know that you're really familiar with Gershwin's Piano Concerto in F, too. And mm-hmm. I read such an interesting insight that you had, which was Gershwin was really trying to write a concerto in the classical model, like Mozart and Mendelssohn and Beethoven. And yet there was this conflict because he just like couldn't help but let his own sort of pop sensibility or Broadway show tune love of melody kind of get in there too. And
well, and also it's his talent, right?
Yeah.
I think it's undeniable that just like, you know, he's responsible for some of the most enduring things in the Great American Songbook. It's, you know, with Porgy and Bess, you've got some of the most memorable melodies out there. So it's this interesting tension. There's this possibly apocryphal story that travels around music circles all the time about Gershwin and Ravel,
mm-hmm.
and about Gershwin meeting Ravel and asking for lessons, and Ravel saying, like, you know, why would you want to be a second-rate Ravel when you are already a first-rate Gershwin? That's one variation of the story. The other variation is, with all the money that you make, I should be taking money from you. But either way, I think that It's a compelling narrative. Whether or not it's completely true, I really don't know. But it's a compelling narrative, this idea that, like, Gershwin is, you know, really wanting to always prove his mettle as a composer. Rhapsody in Blue is sort of the initial foray into that, but he doesn't orchestrate Rhapsody in Blue himself, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. You're right that it feels a little different now. There's I think it's probably extremely out of vogue to argue that pop culture has some inherent inferiority.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that's, you know, we live in much more pessimistic times these days anyway. So it does feel different. It's also a good piece. In addition to all of this extra stuff that I'm hanging around the piece, it's also a good piece.
Well, I wondered if, you know, since it's an earlier piece of his, do you find that there's more freedom in the writing of the Rhapsody than there is in the piano concerto?
I think that probably has more to do with the form being a Rhapsody,
mm-hmm.
Where, you know, it gives him license to just luxuriate in his ideas a little more freely and travel without any particular need for a return to something. I don't know if I would say it's more free than the concerto. I think the biggest difference is that there's less dialogue between orchestra and piano. It's more vacillating between like moments of ensemble revelry and I don't know, hedonism, and then these really gorgeous long piano solos, and then really ecstatic moments where the piano and ensemble are pretty much like in unison. There are moments of conversation, but for the most part, I think it's either like ensemble plays a lot of material, piano plays a long solo. Like there are very long solos in this piece. So yeah. That's probably the biggest difference.
Well, this is a piece that, you know, we know so well, even from, you know, United Airlines commercials. So what do you do?
I think Fantasia 2000.
That's right.
My first reference point for this piece.
So what do you do, and as you're working on it and thinking about it, what do you do to kind of make it fresh and relevant?
I mean, one important part, I think, is not denying, again, like I said, not denying all of the extra associations. Right? Like, it's a fact. It's just a fact. My first exposure to this piece that I really remember is watching Fantasia 2000 in theaters. This piece is a jingle. It's been turned into a jingle, right? Like, it's just a fact. So I'm that's step one, is simply just, like, acknowledging it. I mean, like, that's just the reality. And then I guess the flip side is trying to engage with the score. I don't know. Like when I describe the process of working and learning and rediscovering a piece, I'm realizing I'm trying to keep a lot of paradoxes alive. Like I'm trying to engage with the score without thinking about stylization, trying to consider like why are these things here, like in the most skeletal, like form-based way of thinking. But then, like I said earlier, like, this is undeniably music of a specific time and place. And so there is always a modicum of historical research involved in that. So I do think a lot about like 20s, 30s piano, the recordings and videos I've seen of that period. My personal favorite recording of Rhapsody in Blue is this very wild recording that Earl Wilde did, I think, with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra.
Oh, yeah. But
it's like this massive orchestration, and there's like a show choir in it. It's like so over the top and gorgeous. So that's something that I keep in mind. That's like one pole. And then the other pole is like Oscar Levant playing, which is, really, you know, particular and dramatic, and in some ways also like disarmingly straightforward. I think that sometimes the mistake that people make with Gershwin is that they layer on all the sugar on top when it's like, I don't think you really have to do that. So it's a combination of trying to do a lot of research so that it's coming from an informed place, but then also kind of trying to forget all of that as well at the same time. So that's I think how I try to keep it fresh, but that's also more generally the case of performance. Even just being on stage, it's like trying to achieve a level of familiarity and deep knowledge of the material so that when you're on stage, you can just like forget about all of it and just actually be present with everyone else.
Yeah, when you get to the point where you can just be on stage and you've done all the prep work, and so now it's just up to you to create something fresh and new. It's an amazing moment. Yeah,
it's an amazing feeling. It's actually in my observation, it's, and in my own experience, it's been like it's a largely like psychological thing too, of recognizing fears in some ways. I often find myself when I'm working with students and when I'm practicing myself, like try to ask myself the question of like, first of all, I try to notice what I'm doing and what my tendencies are, what habits I might be falling into. And I just try to even like identify what they are And then, you know, the next question is why? Why is that happening? And yeah, it's an interesting, it's like constantly interrogating yourself, but trying to do so in a way that is like productive and generative. You know, practicing is like being a gardener or a librarian, where you're just trying to create the ripest conditions possible for discovery. And then performance, I guess, can be thought of as like, I don't know, whatever the spontaneous result of that work is.
Yeah.
And hopefully I can be in a place where it feels like it's just spontaneous and vulnerable, I guess, in that way.
Yeah, and that's definitely, I mean, that would be the goal for sure. And I know that your schedule is planned quite a long way out, and you're often working on pieces that you're not even going to be performing for well over a year. So how do you plan your schedules so that you can keep these pieces in your fingers and in your brain, but you don't like get tired of them or just wear them out?
Well, I don't, that's a constant negotiation. I don't know if I figured it out at all. I don't know. This might, maybe this is evasive. I don't think about it that much. I don't really have a method. One thing I definitely have tried to do is to not take gigs that I don't want to do. To not, you know, to mostly like pick music that I want to play if I can. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy enough. I'm happy to say that at this point I feel able to do that. Also, because like I don't know. I mean, I think I made my artistic intentions actually pretty clear early on, even as they've evolved. So that makes a huge difference. That makes a massive difference. Just like doing work that I actually want to do makes it easier to navigate the challenges of, you know, ordering my practice schedule around. But really, the hardest thing about it, honestly, is that it makes it sometimes challenging to feel. It gives me a certain kind of anxiety sometimes because it makes me feel like, oh, if I have stuff planned out in 2021 or something like that, it's like, I don't know what my life is going to look like in 2021. So sometimes it activates this weird dissonance of that, where it's like, that's not how life works. Or at least ideally, it's not how life works. You know, ideally, you feel very present in your life, and things can surprise you and all that stuff. And sometimes knowing where you're going to be in like 18 months just scrambles with your head in that way. Also, in this extremely, you know, intense, turbulent time of climate crisis and like election year insanity and all that stuff, it feels really strange to be talking about like 2022.
Yeah.
I'm just like, I don't know, when I'm at my worst, I wonder if anything's going to exist in 2022. So on that level too, it's just like that anxious part of me is just like, what am I doing? But also most, I would be remiss if I didn't mention, like, it's also kind of fabulous to know, you know, what pieces I'm going to be doing further in advance. It gives me a sense of, you know, things to do it sometimes. So there's all these different sides of it.
Yeah. Well, we're so glad that you're going to be here really soon performing the Rhapsody in Blue. And Conrad, it's really been fun talking with you. So thank you so much.